Government refuses to engage with UK on plan for a no deal. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Times. Pat Leahy quotes unnamed senior sources in Dublin and Brussels who say that no deal preparations are a unilateral EU matter and that the government and EU leaders are sticking to the position that there will be no discussions with the UK on how to manage a no deal on the border until after the UK has left the European Union. For its lead story, the Irish Examiner reports that Public Expenditure Minister Pascal Donoghue was briefed on an interim report of the Data Protection Commissioner's investigation into the public services card last August. The debt write-off of €2 million on a mortgage and €900,000 in unsecured debts granted to musician Frank McNamara and his wife, barrister and former television presenter Theresa Lowe in the High Court yesterday provides the lead story in today's Irish Independent. The couple had gone to court over the refusal of the Tanager Fund to agree to a personal insolvency deal to help them to manage debts of €3.7 million. A video which was widely circulated on social media yesterday showing a Muslim teenager being egged and having her hijab pulled off her head by a group of youths in broad daylight in Dundrum in Dublin last Sunday is the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mirror and Herald. The Gardaí have issued a statement saying that the incident is not believed to be racially motivated and that they are investigating a number of incidents of public order and theft related to a group of teenagers. And that story is also carried in all of today's other papers. The Irish Daily Star, meanwhile, leads today with the story about how the Workplace Relations Commission has ordered an Indian restaurant in Dublin to pay €3,000 in compensation over the owner's refusal to serve an Indian customer under the Equal Status Act, although Ravi Shukla, the owner of Ravi's Kitchen on Pembroke Road, disputes the case and plans to appeal the ruling. For its lead story today, the Irish Sun interviews Suzanne Power, the wife of Trevor O'Neill, who was shot dead in Mallorca 3 years ago in what is thought to have been a case of mistaken identity. Help me nail my Trevor's brutal murderers is the headline there. A new life expectancy blood test, which has been found to be 83% accurate based on tests carried out on more than 44,000 people, provides the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mail. Douglas Village is in danger of dying on its feet. That's according to a study commissioned by Cork County Council, carried as a lead story in today's Echo. Elsewhere on the front pages, Maria Bailey is pictured on the front of the Mail on foot of her decision to quit as head of the Doyle Ethics Committee. And finally, pictures from yesterday's photo call for this year's Rose of Tralee Festival are carried on the front of a number of today's papers. It's the 60th year of the festival and the 10th year for Dahi O'Shea as presenter.
There's been agreement of sorts between farmers and the meat industry on the issue of beef prices. Discussions began last week after several weeks of pickets by members of the Beef Plan movement outside meat factories. A document has been accepted by all sides. However, farmers say the main issue hasn't yet been resolved. Our reporter Colman O'Sullivan was following the talks. Colman, what happened last night?
Well, Rachel, shortly after midnight last night, the meeting broke up and the groups emerged to talk to me. They said that this document had been accepted. Now, maybe too strong to say that everybody had agreed to it. And what's in the documents? They say that there are changes mainly to the system which is used to grade cattle and decide how much money will be paid to the farmers. So there's this grid which is used to put the cattle into different classes. There will be a review of that which may lead to changes in the prices paid to farmers. There will also be changes to a system by which cattle qualify for a 12 cents per kilo bonus, which will obviously mean something to farmers, and it's expected that up to 200,000 more cattle per year may qualify for that 12 cents bonus per kilo. But really the big question for the farmers obviously is the price per kilo. At the moment it's around 350 per kilo. They say that's too low. They need at least €4 per kilo to break even, to meet their production costs. So I asked Joe Healy about that. Joe Healy, the president of the Irish Farmers Association, what does this document mean for the price the farmers will get at the factories?
Look, there were, as I said to you, there was movement in a number of areas, but price wasn't part of that. And you know, the beef farmers tomorrow will be waking up with getting the same base as they were today and yesterday. and beef farmers will be disappointed with that.
Joe Healy there of the IFA. Coleman, you also spoke to a representative of the beef plan movement, the people who really got the ball rolling on this.
Yes, they were the people who initiated those protests and pickets outside the beef plants, which led to these talks. Now, I asked Owen Donnelly of the beef plan group, will his delegation be recommending this document to their members? And he said that their members will have to reflect on it.
Whilst there was some progress made on some of the smaller issues, we still have some challenges for sure. There's a deal, there's a text, there's a document that's been shared. We have to go and reflect on that in the cold light of day and share that document with our members and get their opinion on it. We've certainly done everything in our power to achieve what they've asked us to achieve on those 13 points. And it remains to be seen now if we have delivered for them in their eyes.
Will you be recommending the sale to members?
We have to reflect on the content of the document in its entirety first. It has literally just been printed or just been finalised. And on that basis, we need to go down through it in a lot of detail now.
Owen Donnelly there, the Western Region Chair for Beef Plan. Coleman, the Minister for Agriculture, Michael Creed, had also become involved in these talks. Was he there last night?
He was, Rachel. Yes, he became involved yesterday on the third day of talks. There'd been no agreement after 2 days, two long days. So he came in. What he did was he first of all met each of the groups individually, and then yesterday evening he got them all together around the table, and after several hours of talks that led to this document being accepted. Now, he was obviously very much working hard to get an agreement. So I asked him that, given the reaction of the farmers, you heard them there, nobody was being overjoyed or being very over-enthusiastic about this document. Does this mean that now, after these talks, that there will be an end to protests at the meat factories?
Well, I do hope so. I was making the point earlier that, look, in any negotiations, nobody comes out with all of the issues, resolved to their individual satisfaction. Beef Plan put some 13 issues on the agenda, and I think, in fact, we made substantial progress on all of them. Not every one of them to the degree that parties would have liked, but we made progress on virtually all of them.
Michael Creed. Coleman, did the meat industry, did their representatives have anything to say?
They didn't speak to us as they left yesterday, so we don't know what their reaction to the document is. So we have to wait and see, really, also to get a more full reaction from the farmers' groups. As you heard there earlier, Beef Plan will be going back to their members. And, of course, the context of all this remains very difficult for everybody because we have Brexit, which means that the value of sterling has dropped very sharply already because of the uncertainty around that. That means the prices that Irish beef is fetching in the UK has fallen. That puts further pressure on the sector. And Joe Healy, speaking to him last night, he said also a big part of the equation is the beef that's been imported from outside the EU that's cheaper than Irish beef, and that puts pressure on Irish beef. He would like the government to do more on that. So really, the future is still quite uncertain in terms of what will happen next. Well, we could yet see more protests outside those factories, depending on the reaction to Beef Plan members to the document. And it's really still a question of wait and see what's going to happen.
Coleman, thanks indeed for that. That was our reporter Coleman O'Sullivan, who was outside those talks last night.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will meet the German Chancellor Angela Merkel later today. He's expected to reiterate his call for the backstop plan to prevent a hard border here be scrapped. Mr. Johnson gave an interview to ITV News last night. Its political correspondent Paul Brand asked him for one solution for the border that he would give to the EU leaders he's meeting this week that has not been suggested before.
Well, I don't think actually that many of the solutions that are available have been properly suggested before. They certainly haven't really been properly offered by the UK side. And of course, there are all sorts of trusted trader schemes, electronic pre-clearing and all the rest of it.
These have all been suggested before. They have been suggested before. They've been explored with the EU before.
None of them have been properly suggested by the UK.
Are you saying then that perhaps Theresa May didn't make the case convincingly
enough? Yes, absolutely. Well, what I'm saying is that if you look at what the UK government was doing, it was basically reconciled psychologically, emotionally, intellectually to remaining within the customs union and within the orbit of EU law.
Boris Johnson talking to ITV News last night. Derek Scally is the Irish Times correspondent in Berlin and he joins us now. Derek, what will Chancellor Merkel say to Boris Johnson?
Good morning, Audrey. Well, what she'll say is pretty much what she said all along. She'll say we want a constructive relationship with Britain in the future on trade and particularly on security, and that there's no chance of reopening the deal that is on the table. And by the way, it's very nice that you're coming to Berlin before you come to Dublin. Well, she won't say that, but she'll say it's Berlin is not a negotiating party, at least not officially. But the fact that he's coming here ahead of he goes to Ireland or going to Brussels suggests, you know, he's carrying on in tradition of David Cameron and Theresa May, who somehow believed that sort of the solution to the way to square this Brexit circle is somewhere here in Berlin somewhere. And the Berliners are fascinated by this, but they appreciate the attention, but they don't really want the attention. They'd much rather he was going to Brussels or elsewhere and trying to find a solution there and instead of writing letters and coming here.
And Derek, is the Chancellor's public position identical to her private position? From what you're hearing, is there any pressure coming from Berlin on Ireland to soften its stance on the backstop?
No, this is the classic dog that didn't bark here. I often get requests, you know, are you sure? Are you really sure? And I said, well, if she hadn't said anything, what do you want me to say that she has said? It's very difficult. She said in public, she said it informally, she said it elsewhere, that Germany stands fully behind the Irish position. And this has been the position consistently from the start, which is not to say if the Irish believe there's something that needs to be adjusted, that Germany wouldn't be in favour of that. But this notion that Germany, because, you know, they're afraid of losing car sales or whatever the British have been saying, for 3 years, it's not that they're not concerned, but they're not going to. Everyone I've spoken to at every level in every kind of party in the last 3 years have said we are not going to stab Ireland in the back. We're not going to dump them in the river just because the British lean on us and we lean on Ireland. So no, that's not really at the moment. It's not going to happen. But what Angela Merkel is saying is, look, are we overlooking something? Is there something we haven't seen? She's very much worried at this late stage in her position, after she's been in Paris since 2005. She's looking at her legacy. Is there something we're overlooking? Is there something we could perhaps put into the future? We could offer them at least a dangle in front of them for the future arrangement with the EU that would make the backstop somehow less of an issue politically for the British. You know, is there anything there? She's just somebody who believes, she's a scientist, you know, trying every experiment before you give up before October. So that's really what she's been trying to do. But really public opinion as well in Germany is completely on the Irish side. I mean, I've just done what it says in the papers, what it says in the German papers, and you know, the conservative FAZ is calling his talk of alternative arrangements hot air, and the left-wing Taz newspaper is saying, you know, we cannot sacrifice an EU member just to placate the departing UK, and the centre-left Süddeutsche, the most read daily newspaper, we cannot yield to blackmail. Boris Johnson's dilemma, his electoral dilemma, you know, about the Brexit party and so on, it should be immaterial to the EU, and this, his letter is just more targeted provocation, and the EU should remain united. So really on the political level, in the public debate, there's really nobody on the British side as far as I can see, and the Irish perhaps just need to remain calm and see what Mr. Johnson will say in Berlin and what he says whenever he gets around to coming to Dublin.
And Derek, is the German Parliament, is it preparing and passing legislation to prepare for a no-deal Brexit? I know there are many, many British people living in Germany. Will they be allowed to stay on after a no-deal Brexit?
Yes, remarkably so. The Germans, who are known for their love of bureaucracy, have actually been rather pragmatic. British friends I know have been getting letters in the post saying, don't worry, we have an arrangement in place for you. It's a rather unusual arrangement, but it is an arrangement. And also I've talked to British business or German businesses, and they say, look, we've even the notorious car industry, which apparently is going, according to the British, will lean on Germany at the last minute and get them to lean on Ireland. They say, look, we've already factored this in. We will lose some sales in the UK, but you know, the European market is dwarfed by the Chinese market, the UK, the US market, and we've also got our supply chain sorted, so we won't be stuck for parts. And on the political level, yes, they've been passing one package of Brexit legislation, emergency legislation, after another. So the Germans have said, as far as one can prepare, they are prepared. But of course, they're heading into recession, so that makes some people nervous here. You know, any lost customers or any lost market isn't helpful at a time like this. But there's really no sign on the horizon yet that Ireland, that Germany is moving away from Ireland's side, or that Mr. Johnson will get anything more than a polite but distant reception when he arrives in Berlin this evening.
How's he regarded in Germany?
Well, I mean, I was here, I was in the meeting when he had, when he came here in November 2016, the first time as foreign minister's inaugural visit, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, he's now the president. Back then, he was the foreign minister, and I've never seen him struggling so much to be diplomatic. I mean, he was the chief diplomat at the time, but, you know, Boris Johnson did a few bubbly words in German, and then at the end of their joint press conference, he tried to give Mr. Steinmeier a fist bump. Mr. Steinmeier just wanted to shake his hand. I mean, he was literally, with every cell in his body, was rolling his eyes. So he's not really considered a serious person here, but of course he is the Prime Minister, and it is a serious situation. So Chancellor Merkel today will go all the way out to be polite to him, but it's interesting the arrangements. He's getting the full military honours. It is an inaugural visit, after all, but there's no press conference. It's very unusual for a visiting leader not to get a press conference. Instead, he's getting a brief statement before they have talks, and there'll be no questions, and there'll be no press conference and questions afterwards. So the Germans are very much putting a tight corset on things. They know they will get some grandstanding in the statement from Mr. Johnson, but they don't really want to give any extra oxygen because, as they've said from the start, they're not officially a party to these negotiations.
Derek, great talking to you. Thank you, Derek Scally, the Irish Times correspondent in Berlin. It's 25 past seven.
Department of Communications has said it will consider a report by the Oireachtas Communications Committee which recommends that the broadband network remain in public ownership. The government is due to sign a €3 billion agreement with the last remaining bidder, a consortium led by Granaghan McCourt, next month. The committee has also called for a new cost-benefit analysis of the plan to bring broadband to rural homes and businesses. We're joined by one of the committee's members, the Green Party leader, Eamon Ryan. Good morning.
Morning, Rachel.
Do you have any reason to believe that the government will accept any of these recommendations?
I think one of the main reasons they should is for value for money. Their own Department of Public Expenditure and Reform raised real concerns. It's not just the committee, that we could spend our money better. Two examples. The plan is a complex and it's an important project. We are all agreed in the committee, actually, this has to happen. We do have to roll out high-speed broadband to rural Ireland. We're all agreed on that. But part of the plan is to include 60,000 new houses. And rather than subsidising that, where the taxpayer comes, after the new house is built, comes back in with the digger and puts in a ducting or puts in telegraph poles into the house, what I believe we should do, one of the recommendations, is to say a condition of any planning permission on a new house is the new house builder makes that connection, pays for that connection. It's much cheaper to do it when the house is being built. And we want to incentivise people to build closer to existing villages so the cost wouldn't be astronomical. That's a way we could save a certain amount of that €3 billion budget in a way I think that is fair. And it's a practical change in the project. But secondly, and I suppose this is my own personal view, but the other committee members share it, in a project where we're putting in €3 billion, the developer's putting in €200 million, I believe it's right, even at this stage, to say that in 25 years' time, because we put in €3 billion, the developer only €200 million, and we're doing a huge amount of regulating and checking of this project, we should own the asset in the end. Even if the project stayed as is, the final asset ownership, I cannot get my head around the argument that a developer puts in €200 million, we put in €3 billion, and they end up owning it.
Should the government then walk away from this proposed deal, or should it just try and change the terms of the deal? What are you saying?
People have different views. My view is we should try and change the terms. I would not like to go back to just completely start again, wait another 4 or 5 years of haggling. I'd prefer, there is an urgency, there is a need for us to provide rural broadband in a way that allows people work from home, develop education and other resources. There is a real benefit.
And do you accept that people have been waiting long enough? Because 10 years ago, when you were communications minister, you announced a plan to bring broadband to all of the country. It was supposed to happen by September 2010.
And it did, on budget, in time. But the world has changed since then in terms of the speed of connection we need is far higher, and the technology keeps changing. So that experience that I had then, in where we actually rolled out a plan within 2 years, not the 7 years it's taken this government to do it, and we did it on time and on budget, shows that you can do things quickly if you have the political will and if you organise properly. This is complex, this is not easy, but we need to get it right. Contracts have not been signed, and before they are, I think the government should listen to what the committee is saying, look at the evidence that we've raised, and try and improve the value of the deal for the Irish public, including those who are getting the broadband, but also including the Exchequer, because the money we could save, we can use on a whole range of other services we also need.
But there's no onus on the government, is there, to accept any of this? And the Fine Gael members of the committee, including Senator Tim Lombard, I'm looking at a quote here from him, said change couldn't be made without rerunning the entire process, which could take several years.
I don't agree with him on that. And I think that's the political question. Are they willing? I mean, the project, firstly, isn't finalised yet. There's still a question as to whether we'll use some ESB poles or air poles to get to every house. It's still going to take 7 years under the government's plans to actually roll this out. So it's not as if you snap your fingers and everyone's going to have rural brand in the next few months. I believe it is right, even at this last minute and last stage, to look and see to make sure we get the right terms, rather than what we saw happen in the National Children's Hospital, that a contract's assigned and then you can't do anything about
it. Right, so just to be clear about this, you're not saying walk away, you're saying change the terms of the deal. But will that be possible at this late stage?
I believe it is, if there's political will. It's not easy. It's complex. It's a highly complex project. But I think just saying, oh, no, we can't change anything because we set out on this course, when, as I said, the Department of Public Expenditure is raising real concerns. We had academics in from the University of Limerick who are experts in the whole drafting of public-private partnerships who raised real concerns. And just from the evidence we heard, I believe there are ways which we can save money and still, in my mind, one of the key issues is keeping the asset in public ownership. I think the government should heed that advice. They will have to make the final call. It is a political call for the government. But I think the message they're getting from the committee is clear, is actually look at the evidence that we heard, look at some of the ideas that have come up and see if you can introduce into the scheme.
Green Party leader Eamon Ryan, thank you for joining us this morning. It's 7:30.
Facebook is to allow its users control data about their online activity, which is shared by apps and websites with the social network. The feature is called Off Facebook Activity, and it'll be available in Ireland, Spain and South Korea before it's rolled out across the world. The British government has said it'll start automatically enrolling UK firms in a customs system as it speeds up its preparations for a no-deal Brexit. The move will enable UK firms to continue to trade with EU member states after the UK leaves the EU. 71 pubs closed in rural Ireland last year. Analysis by the Drinks Industry Group of Ireland shows nearly 20% of rural pubs closed between 2005 and 2018, compared to 1% in Dublin. It's calling on the government to reduce the alcohol excise tax over the next 2 years. Taking a look at the currencies, €1 buys 91.3 pence sterling and $1 11 cents.
And at 25 to 8, it's good morning to John Murray.
Good morning to you, Audrey. We begin with Gaelic Games and the news that Galway hurling manager Micheál Donoghue has stepped down after four seasons in charge of the Tribesmen. Of course, he brought All-Ireland glory to Galway in 2017, bridging a 29-year gap, although this year Galway failed to make it through the round-robin series in Leinster. Donoghue's decision to resign was relayed to the Galway County Board last night. Its chairman, Pat Kearney, joins us now. Pat, good morning. Did this come as a big surprise?
I suppose it did, John. I suppose it came as a surprise. Micheál informed us last night that himself and his management team were standing down, and I just want to publicly acknowledge on behalf of all involved in Galway Micheál's contribution and that of his selectors, Noel Arkin and Fanny Ford, and the extended backroom team and medical team that they've made to Galway and set up the position in late 15. And, you know, I suppose we were lucky enough in 16, we were beaten by a pint by Tipperary eventual champions. 17, who will ever forget the fantastic victory in 17, bridging the long gap and the joy that brought to Galway people home and abroad. And last year's effort just came up short by 1 point against Limerick, and as you referred to there, this year probably injuries and that, and things might not have went as well as Micheál and his lads wanted and everybody expected. And I suppose we have to accept Micheál's decision. He's put a huge effort and huge personal commitment into the thing with a young family and that, and we thank him for his efforts, and that's where we are.
And what about the search now for a replacement?
Well, no, John, it's very early this morning. It's only 7 o'clock this morning. And this is only breaking news late last night. The process will begin, I suppose. We're on the same boat as many counties have been in the last number of years, and counties will be in again, because inter-county management is a tough job and a difficult job, and that's obvious from the number of changes in football and hurling over the last number of years. We will start the process, and hopefully by the 1st of October we'll have a manager in place. With the Gala Management Committee, we'll discuss it and we'll presume the process, but I expect by early October we'll be up and running, and hopefully we'll put Galway back on the map again next year.
All right, Pat Kearney, Chairman of the Galway County Board, thank you very much for joining us. Meanwhile, Kilkenny star Richie Hogan insists he didn't deserve a red card for his challenge on Tipperary's Cathal Barrett in Sunday's All-Ireland final. In an interview with News Talk, he said the challenge was clearly accidental and honest. Hogan said, "I watched it back a couple of times. My elbow doesn't connect with his face. My shoulder does." He said he didn't blame referee James Owens, Cathal Barrett or anyone. He added, "Hurling is an incredibly difficult game to referee. There's a set of rules there, but it's hard to make up rules to fit the actual game. They spoke about your arm not being down by your side. This is not Irish dancing. We have hurleys in our hands. How do we hold a 36-inch hurley without bending your arm?" Elsewhere in soccer, in the English Championship, Sheffield Wednesday are top of the table after a 1-0 defeat of Luton Town at Hillsborough. Elsewhere, there were wins for Birmingham, Bristol City, Blackburn Rovers and Middlesbrough. Aston Villa's head of football development, Kevin MacDonald, has left the club following an investigation into allegations of bullying. MacDonald had a spell as Republic of Ireland assistant manager under Steve Staunton. The big race of the day is the Judgment International at York. Aidan O'Brien has two runners, Japan and Circus Maximus. Michael Stout's Crystal Ocean goes off as favourite. Here at home, there's racing at Killarney. The first is off at 2:10. For sports news updates during the day, you can check out the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie. Rachel.
A new floating plastic collector, or sea bin, will be installed in Dublin's Howth Harbour later today. It follows fundraising by a local marine biologist, Rowan Byrne. Earlier this year, two similar bins were installed in Dunleary after money was raised by schoolgirl Flossie Donnelly. Both Rowan and Flossie are with us this morning, and good morning to you both. Rowan, let's start with you. What is a sea bin?
Well, it's essentially, as the name suggests, a bin that floats in the sea that has a pump at the base of it, which basically just breaks the surface of the water, just enough for anything floating by to pop into it and be collected in a net in the bin. Then you lift the net out and you take the plastic away for recycling or disposal.
So it involves somebody going to the bin. Do they have to go every day and check what's in it, or how does it work?
They may have to go a couple of times a day, depending how much plastic is floating by, but generally probably once a day would be sufficient. But the idea is to make sure that anything floating on the surface, whether it's oil residue, plastics, plastic bags, bottles, whatever it is, it just doesn't get recirculated in the system and is taken out of the sea.
Flossie, you've already been involved in something similar in Dunleary. Where did you get the idea from?
I think it was 2 years ago now. My mum showed me a picture on her Facebook page of a sea bin, because I just started beach cleaning, and I just cared about the marine life and wanted to help clean the beach and save the world in that way. So when my mum told me about the sea bins, I just really wanted to get one, just so I can collect the boat oils that it also collects, and all the plastic that's out in sea, which I wouldn't be able to collect. So, I decided to fundraise for that, which went really well.
It did, because you managed to raise the funds for two bins, and now Rowan has done something similar in Howth. What sort of response have you had from people since they learnt about all of this?
Well, since people have learned about sea bins or anything like that, I've just been really happy that people have managed to get more, because it's good to have two, but we need like more sea bins. Not so many that we can't see the sea anymore, we can just see the sea bins, but no, we need more sea bins, we need more people cleaning the beaches, we need just anything like that.
We don't normally ask guests on this programme how old they are, but sometimes it is relevant. What age are you, Flossie?
I am 12 years old.
And you're going into secondary school, what?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow? It's an awful lot to take on for somebody who's only 12. In fact, it would be an awful lot for any of us to take on. Where do you find the time?
Well, as I say to many people, I kind of have even my life out in two separate ways. I have my normal child Simpsons watching life, where I'd go to school, watch the Simpsons, do anything like that. And then I have my life, which I managed to like squeeze in together, where I'm cleaning the beach, doing a talk, anything like that. I just learned how to even it out well. And yeah, now it's just life.
Rowan, tell us about your involvement in all of this. Why did you decide? You also had to fundraise.
Yes.
to get the money for this bin in Howth.
I come home frequently, and I was in Howth in February. And as a child, I used to go up and harass the poor fishermen to say, have you got any sharks? And they'd give me a dogfish and what have you, and hang around the harbour. And I just saw plastic in the sea and around the harbour. So I said, look, we can't do this anymore. This day and age is ridiculous. So literally following Fosse's lead, I went on crowdfunding, raised the money with my employer as well, Matt MacDonald, and contacted the harbour master and said, Harry, can we do something about this? He says, no problem, let's rock and roll. So it's really to create change, given that plastic fragments, it breaks down into the food chain, it affects from any filter feeding organisms to fin fish to larger marine mammals. And you often have to ask the question, who's at the top of the food chain? Well, who eats the fish, and how will this affect them, and how will it affect us? So there's a bigger picture here as well. My aim is to try and do more. And I would encourage anyone to follow Fosse's lead, get in contact. Let's do more, because this is our problem we need to solve.
Should you, though, have to fundraise for something as important as this? Shouldn't there be a national scheme?
I think you're probably right. I think there should be an investment in innovation in this technology in order to solve this problem. Solutions are at the key, at the base of this. So I think if there is an opportunity for government funding, for private funding, for academic support to actually do more research here, I would support that. I think it's a great idea.
Flossie, what's next for you? Are you hoping that similar bins will be installed in other areas, or what would you like to see happening?
Well, it's a popular demand now that we have get more bins, so that's a maybe. We might have to get more. But no, at the moment I have a couple of talks planned out. I'm still going to be cleaning the beaches. I'm going to start secondary school, so my mum and everyone's been trying to take the pressure off me. I'm still doing stuff, but I'm going to do a lot less now, just because I'm going to secondary school.
Right. And what's happening later on today? Are you going to be in Howth as well?
Yep, later on we're going to Howth to see the sea binge, which I'm very excited about.
Well, listen, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland. Flossie Donnelly there, and also Rowan Byrne.
The property website daft.ie has been ordered not to publish any ads which discriminate against people. The ruling was made by the Workplace Relations Commission following a case taken by the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. Mike Allen of Focus Ireland says the ruling will not help everyone who's looking for a home, but he believes it's a start.
It doesn't change the substance of the situation. If landlords are going to make judgments about people simply because of their circumstances or the colour of their skin or their age or their gender, this won't change that. That's still illegal, but it doesn't get to that. But it does change the public conversation about it and the presentation. And if you're in emergency accommodation for 1 year or 2 years with your family, and you're looking at all the ads in the paper and they're saying that they don't want people like you, that is heartbreaking, and it's very destructive. So the fact that people won't be able to say that anymore at least changes the public perception. But we still need to deal with the substance of it, which is the actual decisions and choices that landlords are making. We recognise that part of what landlords need to do is make a decision about getting a good tenant. And we're not saying that landlords should just accept tenants that are not going to be good tenants. But we're saying that they should make a judgment about who's a good tenant on the basis of the individual, the family that they're actually interviewing, rather than something about them, such as their economic status or their gender or their age or their ethnicity.
Well, that's Mike Allen there, Director of Advocacy with Focus Ireland. We asked daft.ie for an interview this morning. They weren't available. We can talk now to Tony Gagan. He's with the Human Rights and Equality Commission, and he's with us this morning. Tony, you're welcome.
Thank you for joining us.
And why take this case? What were you in the commission seeing online that you didn't like?
Well, we took this case in the public interest, and that is the function of the Human Rights Commission, is to promote human rights and equality within the country and to try and uphold it. It was on foot of complaints last year. We had over 110, I think it was 111 individual complaints about discriminatory advertising. So this isn't something that we took lightly. It was on the basis of public interest. And we didn't go straight to the WRC. We engaged initially with DAFT and looked to mediate the process. And thought for some time that perhaps we had, as you'll see, the case is ongoing since 2016. So it's been a long road of back and forth.
And the sort of language that was being used, it was rent allowance, not accepted, for example.
Primarily it was about social welfare, about economic status, also about marital status and family. And I think, as in your earlier clip, Mike Allen pointed out there, and most of the housing agencies, all of them, in fact, I know McFerries and DePaul have welcomed this ruling as well, because it is important in that it changes the public narrative, that if we're allowing those type of ads to continue, it creeps into the public acceptance that social welfare equals bad, you know, or that people that are economically disadvantaged are bad, equal bad tenants. And we know, of course, that that just isn't the case. And most right-minded people know that, and most landlords would know that. But it stops that narrative becoming the norm within the public. And on that level alone, this is a very important ruling.
Was it in their terms and conditions, though, DAFT.ie, for this sort of language not to be used in ads?
Yeah, well, we had asked that they wouldn't use these. We pointed out to them that it was contrary to the Equal Status Act. And that was on that basis that we took the case to the WRC.
But it was still being published.
But they were still being published regularly. And as I said, the public were notifying us about it. The second aspect of this, the broader significance of it, is that it gives absolute clarity now for individuals and Irish companies that are posting advertising online, that they have a responsibility for the content that they post on their websites, that they cannot sidestep or abrogate the responsibility by saying, oh, we're a mere conduit for information, or we're just an information provider, that they, and the ruling was specific in that it asked that they develop a methodology that will address this issue. Okay. So I think that's very important as well, and will have wider significance in a number of spheres in the online world.
And you talk there, Tony, about how you believe this will perhaps change the conversation about social housing equaling bad. But as Mike Allen said, it won't make a huge amount of difference to people looking for a house, because it will not stop landlords asking people when they show up to view a property if they're on rent allowance and so on.
No, it won't. And Mike is quite right in that regard. And of course, we don't change deep-seated things very quickly. You know, it takes time. And this is a step in that direction. By not allowing the ads to continue, it stops that attitude perpetuating. And it allows us the space to try and engage with people more. Because in actual fact, in many ways, social welfare is more secure. If someone has a HAP tenancy, the rent is guaranteed, the property is guaranteed, that if there's any problems, it'll be reinstated, etc., etc. So we need to have more of that information available to landlords, because most landlords will be very happy with this situation. This is to address the people that continue to promote discriminatory advertising.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us this morning, Tony Gagan, who's a member of the Human Rights and Equality Commission. It's 7:51.
Did you ever browse online for a new jacket and later see ads for jackets on Facebook? Well, businesses often share data about people's interactions on the websites with Facebook. The social network is introducing a new way to view and control what it calls your off-Facebook activity. The new tool lets you see a summary of the apps and websites that send Facebook information about your activity. It also allows you clear this information from your account if you want to. To shed more light on the new tool and how it works, I spoke with Stephanie Max, product manager at Facebook.
Off-Facebook activity is part of a series of announcements over the last couple of years focused on transparency and control. It covers information businesses share with us about people's activity on apps and websites. People can view or disconnect this information from their account.
Do you think that Facebook users were aware that businesses share their interactions with Facebook?
We know that this is a very common industry practice, where businesses might share information like this with ad platforms and analytics platforms. We don't know if this is a very well understood practice, so we wanted to lean in to provide transparency and control over this information And we hope that it's the start of a broader industry conversation about how we can provide more transparency and control like this.
It'll be rolled out in Ireland, Spain and South Korea before it's rolled out globally. Why did Facebook choose Ireland?
Ireland is a very important market for Facebook for many reasons, not the least of which is because our international headquarters is located here. It's also the location of the Data Protection Commission, our lead supervisory authority in Europe. But in addition to this, Ireland is English-speaking, which is a very common language on our platform. This enables us to receive good product feedback and understand how the product is working in the test phase.
Now, it's been introduced in Ireland. Will Facebook users in Ireland be able to access it immediately?
We will be rolling out over the coming weeks. It was a complex change to our infrastructure, and we want to take the time to get it right. And so we're focusing on doing that, but all Irish users should receive it shortly.
And what will it mean for businesses? Will they lose out on data that up to now was valuable to them?
People will begin to have transparency and control over this data, and that is good for businesses because people want this kind of transparency and control. It builds trust. So it's both good for businesses and good for people.
And can users switch off their off Facebook activity with all businesses or with certain businesses?
You can turn off the off Facebook activity granularly for individual businesses, or you can do it holistically for all businesses. So you have the choice.
Will Facebook lose advertisers if they cannot target ads at people like before?
We expect that businesses will receive this positively because this will help build more trust amongst people. When we provide more transparency and control, what we found in research is that it really is good all around.
Why is Facebook introducing it?
Facebook feels like this particular practice is very common but not well understood, and we wanted to start a broader industry conversation about how to provide more transparency and control for people. We think that this is important, and we really want them to have the kind of transparency and control that this new tool offers.
Stephanie Max, product manager at Facebook, speaking to me from the US. Facebook's founder Mark Zuckerberg first announced plans for this data control feature last year in the aftermath of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Irish people will be able to access it in the coming weeks before it's rolled out to the rest of the world. It'll be interesting to see what people make of it. More at 8:30. For now, back to you, Rachel.
Let's go to Met Aaron now. We're joined from there this morning by Harm Laux. Good morning, Harm.
Good morning from Met Aaron. Well, today will start mainly dry with some sunshine. However, rain on the west coast will spread across the country during the day, reaching the east early this afternoon and the southeast by evening. A clearance will follow in the west and north later in the day. Highest temperatures of 16 to 18 degrees, and it will become breezy as well with fresh southerly winds. Tonight it will become dry in most areas with lowest temperatures of 12 to 14 degrees. Tomorrow then, Thursday, will be a dry day in the east and south, with sunny spells breaking through. Outbreaks of rain and drizzle will affect the west and north, and will become quite warm everywhere, with highest temperatures of 18 to 22 degrees, but it will still be breezy at times. Friday, Saturday and Sunday will be warm days, with spells of sunshine. There will be a lot of dry weather, but on Saturday a few showers are likely. Temperatures will be in the low 20s on Friday and Saturday, and perhaps up to 25 degrees on Sunday. But now back to today, mainly dry and bright this morning. However, rain on west coasts will gradually spread across the country during the day. A clearance will follow in the west and north later. Highest temperatures of 16 to 18 degrees, and it will become breezy everywhere. That's the forecast. A very good morning.
Patients who go abroad for treatment because of long public waiting lists are facing significant delays in getting reimbursement from the HSE, according to figures obtained by RTE News. The reimbursement under the EU Cross-Border Healthcare Directive is supposed to be made within 30 days, but all are delayed by at least 3 months. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
Under the EU Cross-Border Healthcare Directive, patients are entitled to be treated abroad under certain rules and have the cost of their care paid for afterwards by the HSE. Figures show that there are now delays of over 3 months for patients seeking repayment. The HSE said there are currently around 2,500 applications to be processed, and it has apologised for the delays, which it said are due to the volume of claims and manpower issues. The cost of the scheme has increased from close to €2.5 million 3 years ago to over €12 million last year. The number of claims has also increased from over 1,000 3 years ago to nearly 3,900 last year. Some patients have also reported problems in making contact with the main office in Kilkenny. The HSC said that there are limited telephone lines to this office, but this is being addressed and extra lines will be opened in the coming weeks.
Gardaí investigating the attempted theft of an ATM in Virginia in County Cavan this day last week have recovered what's described as a significant amount of cash. Two men in their 30s have been arrested. A 28-year-old man has also been arrested on suspicion of committing money laundering offences. Talks between farmers' groups and Meat Industry Ireland on beef prices ended in the early hours of the morning. Farmers' representatives are to assess proposals set out in a document drawn up during the negotiations, but cautioned that while progress had been made, the prices paid to beef farmers will still be too low. Colman O'Sullivan reports.
The deal includes a commitment to review how cattle are graded by factories and the specifications demanded of farmers and producers. None of the farmers' groups who spoke to RTE News after the meeting could say they were happy. Beef Plan say they will bring the document back to their members but will have to assess it in the cold light of day and can't say it will mean no more protests at factories. The IFA says while progress was made, the prices paid to beef farmers will still be too low. Minister for Agriculture Michael Creed, whose intervention in the talks led to this deal, said it lays the foundation for better relations between farmers and factories.
The former Vatican Treasurer Cardinal George Pell has lost his appeal in Australia against his conviction for child sexual assault. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison in March after he was found guilty of abusing two 13-year-old choir boys in the 1990s. Cardinal Pell, who's 78, is the highest-ranking Catholic Church prelate to have been convicted of child sex offences. The High Court will give its decision this morning on an application by Ryanair seeking an injunction preventing a strike by some of the airline's pilots, which is set to take place tomorrow and Friday. Mr. Justice MacDonald is due to hand down his ruling after 10:30 this morning. The Taoiseach, Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney, held discussions with the Northern Ireland Secretary Julian Smith at Hillsborough Castle in County Down last night. Afterwards, Mr. Coveney said he believed efforts to restore devolved government at Stormont would intensify. Today, Mr. Coveney is embarking on a tour of five European capitals, during which he'll seek assurances of the continued support for the backstop. Our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman.
The Taoiseach and Julian Smith and their senior officials met for several hours in Hillsborough, the official residence of the Northern Ireland Secretary. At a time when Brexit is demanding attention, as well as straining British-Irish relations, they both seem determined to keep a focus on restoring power-sharing government at Stormont. Simon Coveney said you will see an intensification of efforts from both governments in the coming days. On Brexit, Mr. Coveney confirmed he is to visit several EU capitals, in his words, reinforcing the solidarity that has been shown to Ireland. He said one of the points that emerged from Monday's telephone conversation between the Taoiseach and the British Prime Minister is they both want to avoid a no-deal Brexit. He said this was further reinforced in his own discussions with the Northern Ireland Secretary and in a telephone conversation with Britain's Brexit Secretary. The Taoiseach said 2.5 months may seem like a very short period, but a lot can happen in that time. Tommy Gorman, RTÉ News, Belfast.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is holding talks in Berlin today with Chancellor Angela Merkel before meeting the French President Emmanuel Macron tomorrow. A compensation package for the last remaining stallholders at Dublin's Smithfield Fruit and Vegetable Market is believed to involve up to €5 million. The 127-year-old market is closing this Friday for a redevelopment that could take more than 2 years. The US President Donald Trump has said he's postponing a state visit to Denmark because its Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said Greenland wasn't for sale. Mr. Trump raised the idea of the US purchasing Greenland last week. In a tweet, Mr. Trump thanked Ms. Frederiksen for being so direct, saying she had saved them both a great deal of expense and effort. And the time is now 8:05.
RTÉ Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Planning a day flying or sailing?
Stay clear of overhead wires. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999. Stay safe. Stay clear.
It'll be dry and bright at first. Rain on west coasts will spread across the country during the day, reaching the southeast by evening. A clearance will follow in the west and north later in the day. Highest temperatures will range from 16 to 18 degrees. It'll become breezy with fresh southerly winds. And there's a warning that south to southwest winds will reach gale force for a time today on coasts from Valencia to Slinehead to Malinhead.
The government's refusal to engage with the UK on a plan for a no-deal Brexit, a celebrity couple's debt write-off and a Garda investigation into an assault on a Muslim teenager in Dublin are some of the stories on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times leads with the line that the government and EU leaders are sticking to the position that there will be no discussions with the UK on how to manage a no-deal on the border until after the UK has left the European Union on the basis that no-deal preparations are a unilateral EU matter. For its lead story, the Irish Examiner reports that Public Expenditure Minister Pascal Donoghue was briefed on an interim report of the Data Protection Commissioner's investigation into the Public Services Card last August. The debt write-off of €2 million on a mortgage and €900,000 in unsecured debts granted to musician Frank McNamara and his wife, barrister and former television presenter Theresa Lowe in the High Court yesterday, provides the lead story in today's Irish Independent. A video which was widely circulated on social media yesterday showing a Muslim teenager being egged and having her hijab pulled off her head by a group of youths in Dundrum in Dublin last Sunday is the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mirror and Herald. Gardaí have issued a statement saying that the incident is not believed to be racially motivated and is still under investigation. The Irish Daily Star meanwhile leads today with the story about how the Workplace Relations Commission has ordered an Indian restaurant in Dublin to pay €3,000 in compensation over the owner's refusal to serve an Indian customer, although Ravi Shukla, the owner of Ravi's Kitchen on Pembroke Road, disputes and plans to appeal the case. For its lead story, the Irish Sun interviews Suzanne Power, the wife of Trevor O'Neill, who was shot dead in Mallorca 3 years ago in what is thought to have been a case of mistaken identity. A new life expectancy blood test, which has been found to be 83% accurate based on tests carried out on more than 44,000 people, provides the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mail. Douglas Village is in danger of dying on its feet. That's according to a study commissioned by Cork County Council, carried as the lead story in today's Echo. There are pictures from yesterday's photo call for the 60th Rose of Tralee Festival on lots of today's front pages this morning. Just 81 childminders working in Irish homes are registered with TUSLA. That's on the front of today's Times. And Maria Bailey is pictured on the front of today's Mail following her decision to quit as head of the Doyle Ethics Committee. Elsewhere this morning, there are a number of vandalism-related stories in today's papers, one of which is the destruction carried out by somebody who used a drill to destroy 88 recently installed solar-powered lights along Crosshaven Walkway in Cork. That's in the Times and Examiner. And the Examiner also reports on how cavity blocks were used to smash the heavy-duty plastic dugouts used by Ringmahon Rangers Soccer Club in Cork. The Independent, meanwhile, reports on criminal damage done to new social houses in Carlow, which were due to be handed over to the council in 2 weeks' time. The Star runs with a nice story today about how Robbie Keane's 10-year-old son Robert Jr. has just signed for Middlesbrough FC, the club where his dad is assistant manager. But finally, the Examiner reports today on the potential sale of two of our islands. We're told that Ireland's Eye was included in the recent sale of Howth Castle and Domain to Tetrarch Capital and that the island will still be open to the public, while a crowdfunding website set up by an international socially responsible, eco-friendly community has shortlisted Mannion's Island off the coast of West Cork as one of five islands which it may buy. They've already raised more than €92,000 from 52 investors. The website is called letsbuyanisland.com and the plan is to rename whichever island they do buy as the Principality of Islandia.
The Thánaiste's Simon Coveney says it's realistic to expect a return of power sharing at Stormont before October the 31st, Brexit Day. But he admitted it won't be easy. There's been no government in the north for 2.5 years. Last night, Mr. Coveney met the new Northern Secretary, Julian Smith, to talk about that and about Brexit. Afterwards, he told our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman, that it had been a good meeting.
I think it's really important for lots of reasons that the Secretary of State and myself develop a good personal relationship that's based on trust. We have real work to do in Northern Ireland to help the parties find accommodation of each other. I think the last 2 weeks in particular in Northern Ireland have not been good. The commentary has become coarse, divisive and difficult. And I think we all understand why. And so I think more than ever, there's an obligation on the two governments to show leadership and to show unity together and a sense of purpose that we're going to create positive momentum, which is not easy in Northern Ireland right now.
Is it realistic in any way to think you can get parties to commit to power sharing this side of the Brexit challenge playing out?
I think that is realistic, but it won't be easy. We've spent the last 16 weeks or so talking about the issues that need to be resolved as a basis or a foundation for an executive to be re-established. I think there's been a lot of good work in that period, even though there's also been a lot of frustration because we had hoped to do it a lot quicker. We don't have full agreement on everything yet, we know that. But I do think you will see the Secretary of State and I working closely together to try to get positive impetus back into this process.
In the next few days, next few weeks, or when?
Look, I don't want to put timelines on it. I'm not sure that that's helpful. But certainly, people have taken some well-earned time off in recent weeks. But I think there's a real sense of focus and purpose in both offices, both mine and Julian Smith's now. And I think you'll see an intensification of effort from the two governments in the coming days.
Can I ask you about the exchanges that took place in recent days? Donald Tusk, the Taoiseach, the conversation with Boris Johnson, Boris Johnson's latest comments. Things are not heading towards compromise, it would seem, in the immediate future.
Yeah, but I would say no surprises there. Boris Johnson has outlined the position that his new government is taking on Brexit. It's less compromising. It's not a surprise that the Irish government has reiterated the position that we've held now for a number of years, which is the same as the EU's position. And I think what Donald Tusk has said, what the EU Commission has said today, is absolutely in sync with what the Irish government said today and has been saying for many months. The withdrawal agreement is not up for renegotiation. The backstop is an integral part of that withdrawal agreement. And it's there for good reason. It was designed by the UK and the EU and Ireland working together to try to provide reassurance to people living in Northern Ireland that they're not going to face the consequences of physical border infrastructure in the future on this island. And that's why we are so protective of it. It is Brexit that is potentially putting stress on the Good Friday Agreement and the principles behind it. And the backstop is part of how we mitigate against that damage taking place. So I think what we've seen in the last number of days really is the new British government outlining its position firmly, and the Irish government and the EU responding firmly with their position.
You're off to Denmark. Boris Johnson is off to Berlin.
Paris.
Yeah. So, why are you travelling to those capitals? We know what he's attempting to do.
Actually, in the next few weeks, I'll be to a lot of EU states. Actually, we'll be to Helsinki. We'll be to Prague. We'll go to Warsaw. We go to Copenhagen. So. I think it's sensible for me to spend some time with colleagues in other EU capitals, essentially reinforcing the Irish message and the appreciation that we have of the solidarity that has been shown to Ireland through this Brexit process, as it draws to a to a conclusion. But look, we will be working towards trying to find a way of getting a deal that prevents a no-deal Brexit. But ultimately, this will be a choice for the British government. The EU have been consistent throughout. The British government have not. Unfortunately, we've seen the British Prime Minister say that he will no longer commit to the commitments that he and government made when the commitments to Ireland and to the EU were made in writing in December 2017. You know, our position remains consistent. It remains fair. And in my view, is the only way that we will see a managed, sensible Brexit. The choice remains for both the British Parliament and the British government as to whether they want to work within those parameters.
It would seem that Boris Johnson may be heading towards a no-deal Brexit. And in those circumstances, is the Irish government going to have to start articulating the plans it has to uphold the European Union's single market policy and to protect that those principles? And that's going to involve, surely, some form of controls on the island of Ireland between European Union territory and the United Kingdom.
Well, look, you're making a number of assumptions there. I mean, I think there's a number of things I'd say from the conversations that have happened in the last number of days. Certainly the conversation between the Taoiseach and the Prime Minister would suggest that both want to avoid a no-deal Brexit. Certainly my conversations with the Brexit Secretary today would reinforce that message, that the British government is looking for a way to avoid a no-deal Brexit and wants to find a way of getting a deal done. And that's been reinforced again this evening with the Secretary of State. So I think there's a long way to go here. You know, 2.5 months or less than 2.5 months may seem like a very short period, but in politics, a lot can happen in that period of time. So I think speculating on the detail of how a no-deal Brexit will be managed, it's probably not helpful to do that tonight.
That's the Thornish then, Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney speaking to our Northern editor Tommy Gorman after his meeting last night with the new Northern Secretary Julian Smith. Tommy joins us now. Tommy, a lot in that interview. Let's go back to the talks process about Stormont. He said it was realistic but not easy to have Stormont up and running by October the 31st. Others I talked to there who are close to the process say there's nothing meaningful happening at Stormont. What's your assessment?
Well, that was Simon Coveney on the street in Hillsborough at around 11 o'clock last night after he had spent 4 hours in the company of Julian Smith, the new Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. And I think in relation to the talks and the political situation in Northern Ireland, what he was reflecting was a recognition that there's real tension in communities. There's a sense of frustration. There's no government. There's quite an amount of age. You saw that a bomb attack on police officers in Fermanagh on Monday. And I think Simon Coveney and Julian Smith both recognise that, look, Boris Johnson is coming to Dublin in September. There are decisions going to have to be made about the future of Stormont before the Brexit deadline of October 31st. It's October 21st. Are they going to extend its remit once more, postpone elections once more? And I think he was acknowledging, and Julian Smith acknowledges, it would be much better for everyone if we could get politicians back working together, because it's very, very bad for the ongoing political relationships in Northern Ireland and British-Irish relations. And that's, I think, what he was pointing to there, that they have to try to get politics back up and running before Brexit, I suppose, adds to the tensions.
Yes, and because Dominic Raab has already said, that's the Britain's Foreign Secretary, has already said that if there isn't power sharing up and running by October the 31st, it'll be direct rule.
Exactly, Audrey. Like, it's what, January 2017, since the collapse of Stormont, it's going to be 3 years next January. So how long do you keep postponing? And if you admit that, look, we can't put it together now, well, then you can't just keep it in cold storage forever. And it would maybe involve moving to direct rule. Now, what would that do to tensions between nationalists and unionists? What would that do to a big achievement of the Good Friday Agreement, power sharing, a very practical example of it? And I think there's also a reality that's not sometimes acknowledged. Politicians, like everybody else, OK, they'll enjoy an extended holiday. But after a while, your self-confidence, your lack of dignity, It begins to ease into you and into communities. And the politicians in Northern Ireland really do want to get back together. They do want to get back power sharing. But they're also looking over their shoulders at their own community, and they can't be seen to cave in and compromise. And that's why the governments are very keen once more to try and intervene and help.
Well, that's the thing. And there's a very interesting opinion piece in today's Irish Times by Tom Kelly, who is Tony Blair's former official spokesman for many years. He's from Northern Ireland. He knows the situation there very well. He says that the balance of consensus between traditions in the north is looking precarious, to say the least. The crystal vase is on its way to the polished floor, he says. And many people I've been talking to over the last week as well, Tommy, they say, you know, the attacks by dissidents, the trouble in Derry over the Apprentice Boys parade last weekend, this increase in toxic rhetoric at political level, entrenchment of positions, that things are unravelling quicker than people might have expected.
Audrey, Tom Kelly put it very eloquently, but there are, I suppose, more vulgar manifestations of it. Social media is a good example. If you look at some of the exchanges there, if you look at the chemistry that was evident when Arlene Foster and Michelle Gildernew were interviewed on BBC earlier in the week down in Fermanagh, you could cut the tension with a knife. The discomfort, it made for such awkward viewing. And it's not where most people in Northern Ireland want to be. People are not happy with that level of edge.
Tommy, thank you very much indeed. Tommy Gorman there, our Northern editor.
A compensation package for the last remaining stallholders at Dublin's Smithfield Fruit and Vegetable Market is believed to involve up to €5 million. A total of 11 businesses had to agree to move out before restoration could take place. The redevelopment of the 127-year-old market could take more than 2 years to complete. This report from our Dublin correspondent, John Kilrain.
That's the sound of a Bedford truck at the Smithfield Market one early morning in 1962. It had replaced the traditional horse and cart, and in turn was replaced by diesel forklifts. But from Friday, there'll be silence during the early hours at the Victorian Fruit and Veg Market. Local resident Larry Mooney, who's retired from the market, says he'll miss the sounds.
And I worked in the market all my life, nearly 45 years, and it's very sad to see it go. It's over 100 years old. You know, when I started out, when I was only 14, I'm 70 years of age now. And I have a lawyer in the mornings, but I'm still up the same time, 1:30 in the morning. That's the time we used to go to work, 1:30 in the morning.
Another resident, Linda Fitzpatrick, is also sad to see the market go.
It can be your childhood memories. You know, and so that'll all go now. You know, so we just, it's something you're going to have to get used to, and that's, maybe the pace might be nice as well. Well, I've seen plans 10 or 15 years ago for this. They were showing us the beautiful markets in Barcelona or something like that. But it's not for the locals, it's for visitors.
For many of the traders, the market has been their family history. Joe Duffy's florist stall was started by his grandfather, who married a woman from the market.
We date back right to the 1900s. I think my grandfather was one of the first merchants to come into the market, and he worked in a company called Fletcher's and Sons. My grandfather would have met my grandmother, who was a Brady. The Bradys had potato merchants and seed merchants, and this is how they met. In the 60s, it was very vibrant, very, very busy. Thousands of growers coming in every morning. So it was really before supermarkets got hold of the business. The supermarkets would bring in a lot of their own produce direct themselves because they're big enough. It's like if you look at your greengrocers, your florists, they're in decline over the last so many years, really since the 70s. It's kind of gut wrenching in lots of ways that, you know, I have two children, but they're not keen to continue on.
No one is willing to confirm the exact amount of compensation for the last 11 traders to move out, but it took years to get an agreement.
And negotiations are quite slow at the corporation, but thank God we got there eventually. So it gives me a chance to continue on the business. It'll give me the resources to continue to pay our staff and run it as a business. And I think I'm happy enough at this stage.
Current redevelopment plans envisage 50% wholesale, along with 50% retail. This may have to be revisited because of the changing market, according to independent councillor Neil Ring.
Speaking to a lot of the wholesalers, they've moved off-site, obviously, to facilitate the regeneration and redevelopment. And a lot of them have places now and aren't particularly interested in coming back. And when you see places in London, for example, the Borough Market, which successfully went from wholesale to retail over a number of years and is a really successful market, I think that may be the model we'll be looking at. But again, the councillors agreed 50-50. If that has to change, it'll come back to the councillors. I, for one, and I know speaking to other councillors, we want this area and this building regenerated, redeveloped. So whatever comes back, I think we'll be supporting fully.
Dublin City Council will be going out to tender for a design, build and operate contract for the redeveloped market, explains Assistant Chief Executive Richard Shakespeare.
We're really talking about upgrading everything from the light, the heat, water, you know, sanitary facilities, but also creating the opportunity for 60 to 80 food outlets, you know, everything from meats to bakeries to fish to cheese. It's a great opportunity, I think, to link the retail offer that we have down in from O'Connell Street right the way up through to Smithfield and onto Collins Barracks, in terms of it's a real tourist trail from O'Connell Street up. And it also, you've got to figure out, there's 70 to 80,000 people living directly in it. So I think, you know, a retail food market can be of great benefit to those residents.
There have been plans before which failed because of the recession, and negotiations have caused further delays. But the City Council believes this long-awaited redevelopment is now on track.
Deep-rooted change doesn't happen quickly. And you're better off doing this with, you know, a reasonably broad consensus of opinion amongst everybody. And I think we've actually managed to achieve that by taking our time.
Richard Shakespeare from Dublin City Council, ending that report from John Kilrain.
Online booking platform Hostel World said booking demand over the peak summer period was lower than usual. In its interim results, the Irish company reported revenue of €38.8 million, down 9% on the same time last year. Facebook is to allow its users control data about their online activity, which is shared by apps and websites with the social network. The feature is called Off Facebook Activity, and it'll be available in Ireland, Spain and South Korea before it's rolled out across the world. The British government has said it'll start automatically enrolling UK firms in a customs system as it speeds up its preparations for a no-deal Brexit. US President Donald Trump said he would be putting off a planned meeting with Denmark's Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, because she didn't want to talk about a possible US property deal to buy the island of Greenland. Taking a look at the currencies, €1 buys 91.4 pence sterling and $1.11.
Good morning to you, Audrey. We begin with Gaelic games and the news that Galway hurling manager Micheál Donoghue has stepped down after four seasons in charge of the tribesmen. Of course, he brought All-Ireland glory to Galway in 2017, bridging a 29-year gap, although this year Galway failed to make it through the round-robin series in Leinster. Donoghue's decision to resign was relayed to the Galway County Board last night, who will shortly begin the search for a successor. They hope to have someone in place by the beginning of October. Well, joining me now is a man who brought the Liam McCarthy Cup West on three occasions back in the 80s, resident RTE pundit Cyril Farrell. Cyril, what do you make of this news?
Surprised really, John, like, because the season in the early district, he had a great campaign with all of his management team, Noel Larkin and Franny Ford and the wider management team. Like, they brought in All-Irelands, which hadn't been there for years, senior title, won a Leinster title, won a league and a couple of Welsh Cups, so he was very successful. You know, so this year's into the early, but everyone was surprised because everyone just thought he was going to continue on, no problem.
So what do you think led to his decision? Is it the pressure of the job?
I'd say really it's the time consumption more than pressure, because he has a young family and he's a kind of, you know, a very busy man in his business. And John, the management thing he's taken up is nearly full 24 hours a day and or as near as possible. And it's got very professional. You have all the backup staff as well, and it's getting bigger and bigger, so it's harder to manage. I would think the time is the big thing.
There was no pressure on him, though, was there, this year after the failure to emerge from the round?
Not a thing. People realised that could happen. Look at us. It was unusual circumstances. Maybe the average score against Carlo wasn't high enough. Nearly a freak was up between Kilkenny and Wexford. All these things worked. It was like he had three or four great seasons. There was no pressure to go from the hurling world. Everyone just thought he was going to continue on and we're looking forward to another great year.
So what names are likely to be in the hat when it comes to appointing a successor?
Well, I suppose, really, like, you know, with all the development squads now, John, there's a lot of younger coaches coming up along the lines. Like, you're Brian Handeless, so they've been in three in a row minors, you know, like Jeff Relinsky behind the list as well, you know, winning a lot of titles. They've been the two local ones. And there's other young coaches. Matty Kinney's name will go into the mix again. He's been thereabouts before, like, even though I suppose he's still tied up with Dublin. But, you know, the county board will get together and they'll go through the process. And I'd say they'll find someone really quick.
Micheál Donoghue's legacy will be a positive one, though.
Oh, yeah, listen, there's a lot of good hurlers in Galway. Like, I was at a lot of matches last Friday and Saturday, the championship started again, and there's some quality hurlers. Look, they're good enough, they're going to be thereabouts. John, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. The pieces are there, the players are there, it's a matter of putting them together.
All right, okay. You're not interested in the gig yourself?
Oh, John, I'm getting it hard to imagine myself. I'm delighted to see you.
All right, Cyril Farrell, thank you for joining us this morning. Meanwhile, Kilkenny star Richie Hogan insists he didn't deserve a red card for his challenge on Tipperary's Cathal Barnett in Sunday's All-Ireland hurling final. In an interview with News Talk, he said the challenge was clearly accidental and honest. Hogan said, "I watched it back a couple of times. My elbow doesn't connect with his face. My shoulder does." He said he didn't blame referee James Owens, Cathal Barnett or anyone. Hogan added, "Hurling is an incredibly difficult game to referee. There's a set of rules there, but it's hard to make up rules to fit the actual game. They spoke about your arm not being down by your side. This is not Irish dancing. We have hurleys in our hands. How do we hold a 36-inch hurley without bending your arm?" To soccer news now, and in the English Championship, Sheffield Wednesday are top of the table after a 1-0 defeat of Luton Town at Hillsborough. Elsewhere, there were wins for Birmingham, Bristol City, Blackburn Rovers and Middlesbrough. This year's beaten semi-finalists Ajax were one of six sides in Champions League playoff action last night. Their first leg away to Apol Nicosia ended scoreless. In the other games, Celtic's conquerors Cluj lost 1-0 to Slavia Prague in Cluj, and Club Brugge were 1-0 winners away to the Austrians LASK. Aston Villa's head of football development Kevin MacDonald has left the club following an investigation into allegations of bullying. MacDonald had a spell as Republic of Ireland assistant manager under Steve Staunton. The big race of the day is the Judgment International at York. Aidan O'Brien has two runners, Japan and Circus Maximus. Michael Stout's Crystal Ocean goes off as favourite. Here at home, there's racing at Killarney. The first is off at 2:10. And for sports news updates during the day, you can check out the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie. Rachel.
Former Vatican Treasurer Cardinal George Pell will remain in prison for at least another 3 years after losing an appeal against his conviction for sexually abusing two 13-year-old boys. Pell was convicted of abusing the boys while he was Archbishop of Melbourne in the late 1990s. The announcement was made by Justice Anne Ferguson.
Having reviewed the whole of the evidence, two of the judges of the Court of Appeal, Justice Maxwell, President of the Court of Appeal, and I, have decided that it was open to the jury to be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that Cardinal Pell was guilty of the offences charged.
Outside the court, support groups for victims of sexual violence had gathered. Chrissy Foster, mother of two girls raped by a different priest, said justice had been delivered.
It's a hard crime to get a conviction in the first place. Hardly anyone comes forward, and this has been an outstanding example of justice, and just amazed.
Channel 7's Nick McCallum was in court in Melbourne. He joins us now on the line. Nick, will you bring us through what happened today?
Well, Rachel, it was quite a dramatic moment delivered, as you heard, by Anne Ferguson in a very monotone, factual way. George Pell was in the court. He heard that two of the judges found that it was not unreasonable that a jury found him guilty on the evidence presented to them. So as a result of that, he had to stay in jail. He's been sentenced to 6 years in jail, minimum of 3 years and 8 months. From what we could tell, there was virtually no reaction from him. He did not even blink. He heard what the judges had to say. He then was taken straight back to a prison van and back to the Melbourne Assessment Centre, a prison where he will remain for another few weeks, and then he'll be removed to a more permanent home in a country prison in a place called Ararat, which is about a 3-hour drive from Melbourne. And that's got a special protected unit for convicted paedophiles.
Will you tell us a little about George Pell? Because for a time he was a very senior Vatican official.
He is. He's a very senior Vatican official, as you say. He was always considered the third in the rank at the Vatican. He was effectively the treasury spokesman, the man in charge of the finances. But in Australia, he's had a long history within the Catholic Church. He was an auxiliary bishop in Melbourne in the 1990s. He then became the Archbishop of Melbourne. Then he went on to the most prominent Catholic position in Australia. He became the Archbishop of Sydney, was elected a cardinal, and then moved on to the Vatican. He's always been a controversial figure. He's always been very conservative, always fighting publicly battles on behalf of the Catholic Church, in particular against things such as gay marriage and abortion rights in this country. Also, interestingly, he has been very anti the environment movement. He has been very outspoken that he disagrees with climate change scientists, say, for instance. So he's a very controversial and polarising figure in Australia, even before the bout of child abuse allegations that hit the Australian Church about 10 or 15 years ago.
What's the reaction been to today's decision?
Well, abuse survivors, as you heard from Chrissy Foster, mm-hmm. who's a very prominent abuse survivor, well, her two daughters were abused and her family. She has been a campaigner ever since against child abuse. So, as you heard from her, she was at the front of the court, and there were about 20 or 30 abuse survivors who either were in the court or at the front of the court. They were overjoyed, Rachel, because they believe now, finally, they are being taken seriously. They are getting justice. It has been a long, hard battle for many of them, and they hope that many child abuse victims around the world now will see what's happened here in Australia and will gain hope from that. There is a chance of actually getting justice, no matter how prominent the alleged perpetrator is. On the other hand, there were a number of high-profile Catholics here in Melbourne, some of them in the court and out the front of the court, who were devastated by this. They still believe George Pell is innocent and he is a scapegoat. He has been blamed for all the ills of the Catholic Church over the last few generations. Many of them were in fact in tears at the front of the court, and there were many robust conversations, even arguments, between those who supported George Pell and those who didn't at the front of the court.
Nick, thanks indeed for taking our call. That was Channel 7's Nick McCallum, who was in the court in Melbourne. Just looking at a statement of reaction from the Vatican, it said it acknowledged the Australian court decision to uphold Cardinal George Pell's conviction on sexual abuse, but said he had a right to another appeal. That statement issued within the past short while.
Threats facing the safety of the global food supply now and in the future will be discussed during a two-day conference in Dublin's Convention Centre. 300 delegates from all around the world are at the event, which has been organised by the Food Safety Authority of Ireland. They will be looking at ways to boost the food supply in a sustainable way as the world's population continues to grow. Well, our reporter Tommy Mescal is at the Convention Centre for us this morning. Tommy.
Thanks, Audrey, and good morning from the Convention Centre here in Dublin City. The sun beaming through the glass facade. This is the place where, as you said, people from all over Europe and the world are gathering to discuss how to produce food safely as well as sustainably into the future. The world's population is set to reach almost 10 billion by 2050. That's according to the UN. So that brings with it the major challenge of trying to make sure that safety standards for food don't drop as food producers try and meet those population demands in a sustainable way. I'm joined by Dr. Bernard Earle, Executive Director of the European Food Safety Authority, Nick Andrews as well of Dawn Meats, and also Maeve Cushion of Creme Global is here. Her company advises its clients on packaging, and today she'll be talking about sustainable packaging. But first to Dr. Earle, sustainability, food sustainability is often spoken about, but threats to food safety is perhaps something that people might be less familiar with. What are the challenges that we face?
Well, thank you very much. But let's start with something positive. I think it's fair to say, at least for the European Union, that food has never been as safe as it is now. I think that's a good point, and that's thanks to relentless efforts by farmers, by producers, by national authorities, by EU institutions, a little bit also by EFSA maybe. That's a reason to celebrate, but it's not a reason for complacency, because there are many challenges still out. It's bacteria, it's viruses, it's foodborne diseases, it's chemicals we use in food production, it's innovation that brings new risks, it's global trade, it's climate change, so the menu that we have to deal with is still full.
You mentioned there innovation. How will innovation change how food is produced in the future?
Well, innovation offers, and we need innovation to meet the challenge that you mentioned, that we will have to feed 10 billion people in 2050. So technology is needed, but technology also brings new risks. Think of nanotechnology, think of genetic engineering. So we have to assess the risks so that we can use the benefits, but also make sure that food is safe. Because one thing should be clear, if it's not safe, it's not food.
You also have to boost the food supply, 2 billion growth over the next 30 years in the world's population. How can you do that sustainably? How can you strike the balance?
Well, there will be the need for many measures to be taken on decreasing demand for food, meaning we have to change our diets. We have to fight food loss and food waste. We will have to intensify food production while at the same time conserving biodiversity. So it needs a mix of measures. It's not one or the others. We will have to implement all of them to close this gap.
Because there's a huge waste is a major problem in Europe.
Food waste, I think, is a major problem. I think it's also an ethical problem, because we waste between 20 and 30% of our food, and that's enormous, and much of that could be prevented, so we have to work on that more.
I'll cross over now to Maeve Cushion of Creme Global. You'll be speaking about packaging, sustainable packaging. Is it the case that plastic simply has to go?
I think that's unrealistic at this stage, because plastic offers very effective food packaging materials, and we simply don't have alternatives at this stage that are as effective. So, for example, plastics are very light to transport, and that, in terms of the supply chain, that's very important in terms of energy consumption. But there are definitely some improvements can be made. And that phrase, reduce, reuse, recycle, you know, that order there is deliberate. And with the emphasis on reducing, so for example, reducing the amount of plastic that goes into a plastic bottle, for example, so which would lead to thinner bottles. And this, of course, would have a knock-on effect for consumer acceptability, for example.
We'd be used to seeing, let's say, perhaps nowadays, you know, compostable cups or straws, for example. But simply, you know, a massive switch over to those sort of packaging isn't necessarily a good idea. Why so?
Yeah, you've touched on a very interesting point there. I think the issue about compostability, biodegradability, these terms going around, we have to look at the supply chain, not just from farm to fork, but also beyond that to the end of life of those packaging materials. So we're talking about our waste streams.
Basically, do we have the infrastructure to compost all those cups?
So around the infrastructure, it's different in different European countries. And a project that I'm working on, GlowPack, it's funded by the European Commission, seeks to look at the specific impact sustainability-wise depending on different countries, Ireland being one of them.
I'll switch over now to Nick Andrews of Dawn Meats. Brexit, it's hard to escape it nowadays, and it could have implications for food safety. You're the head of food safety at Dawn Meats. How do you see a no-deal Brexit, which is looming, how do you see that affecting food safety?
Thank you, Tommy. I should point out I'm from Dawn Farm Foods, but thank you for your question. I think in the longer term, the concern is going to be if regulations diverge and then there are different products and different specifications required, and then that's more complexity. But in the short term, with the no deal, I guess it's the main thing is whether the documentation and the delays are going to cause problems with supply chains between the two countries.
UK land bridge. We're familiar with this and you guys use it, but that could become a lot more problematic come the October deadline.
Certainly, yes. If there's additional time required to get to the continent, then Ireland needs to make sure that it's not at a competitive disadvantage to other places within the EU. So for a company like ourselves, for example, we've been testing the direct route from Ireland to France to make sure that that works, and encouraging the government to make sure that the capacity is there for Irish produce to go in both directions.
We'll leave it there. Look, thanks very much, guys, for joining us here at the Convention Centre. This conference, organised by the Food Safety Authority of Ireland, gets underway in just a few minutes' time, and it will continue until tomorrow evening, assessing the risks to food safety and how to boost the food supply in a sustainable way is what it's all about. For now, though, it's goodbye from the Convention Centre, and back to you in studio.
Patients who leave the state for treatment due to long public waiting lists here are facing significant delays in getting reimbursement from the HSE. According to new figures obtained by RTE News, our health correspondent Fergal Bowers has the story. Fergal, this relates to the EU cross-border healthcare directive. Will you remind us, what is it?
Yes, it sounds like a mouthful, but under that directive, patients are entitled to be treated in another EU country under certain rules and have the cost of their care paid for afterwards by the HSE. So it's for healthcare that's available in Ireland, but for various reasons, patients can't get it here. Patients can claim the cost of their treatment abroad up to the amount the treatment would cost in Ireland. And the most common surgeries under this scheme are cataract operations, orthopaedic surgeries, your hip, knee replacements, gynaecology procedures and general surgery. And currently the main countries of access are Northern Ireland, Wales, the UK in general and Poland. And patients availing of this scheme, they need a letter of referral from their GP or a consultant. And in some cases, the HSE advises that prior approval be got for it.
But the patients have to pay the money first. They are due then to get reimbursed. There's a problem, though.
There is. Patients who go abroad for treatment because of long public waiting lists, they're facing significant delays, and that's what the HSE says, in getting reimbursement. The reimbursement under the EU cross-border healthcare directive, it used to be within 30 days, but all reimbursements are delayed now by at least 3 months, the HSE has told me. And that's a problem for patients, especially those who take out loans, often from credit unions for the cost, and are waiting to get their money back, particularly older people. And the European Commission has said that patients should be reimbursed as quickly as possible.
What's the HSE saying about this problem?
Well, it has apologised for these delays, which it says are due to two things. The volume of claims, an increasing number of claims, and manpower issues in the office which operates this scheme. It said there are currently around 2,500 applications that and that the normal turnaround time frame to issue a response is now 75 days. So the figures we see, the cost of the scheme has increased from close to €2.5 million in 2016 to over €12 million last year. And then if you look at the number of claims, just over 1,000 3 years ago and about 3,900 last year. So the HSE said it's working with the Department of Health to deal with the resourcing of the directive office here to levels which reflect the volume of requests and likely future demands. And some patients have told me they've had problems making contact with the main office in Kilkenny, being unable to get through on the telephone line. And the HSE said there are limited telephone lines to the office, but this is being addressed and that extra lines will be put in place in the coming weeks.
You mentioned there the increasing number of claims. Is it safe to assume that this is because hospital waiting lists continue to grow? And while we often focus, say, on trolley numbers in emergency departments, there's this situation every month where you look at the figures of the number of people waiting for all sorts of appointments and it just grows and grows.
It does. There are some reductions in some areas, but I mean, I've been tracking those figures, and over the last year, I mean, they've been going up. And at the moment, 764,000 people are waiting for public hospital treatment or to be seen at a clinic here. A big slice of that, over 500,000, are people waiting to be seen at an outpatient clinic. Now, the benefit, I suppose, of the cross-border directive is you can get treatment abroad as an inpatient, as a day case, or as an outpatient case to be seen by a consultant in another EU country. So you can see that because of those numbers, which are very high and they're at near record levels, certainly, more people are looking to use the scheme. But you wouldn't want to see people out of pocket or waiting for a long time to get money back, especially if they're stretched.
Fergal, thanks indeed. Fergal Bowers there, our health correspondent. More, no doubt, throughout the day.